From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Ford hopes to usher in electric trucks to satisfy its incredibly loyal F-150 customers.
This is a daily work truck. That's why it's the best-selling vehicle in America, that this is run by, you know, construction workers and plumbers and electricians and general contractors, and that can't change.
Also, an exhibition tracks the killing of black Detroiters by the city's police at the height of the civil rights movement.
What you can find in the newspapers, if you find anything at all during this period, was a very brief report that was just the police version of what happened.
And leaders in Lansing attempt to shake up Michigan's investments in higher education.
They're really kind of honed in on the idea that U of M has this massive multi-billion dollar endowment and can't afford to take the haircut.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's show, we're going to catch up with a plan to redistribute Michigan's higher education budget.
And anybody knows anything about endowments, just because you have $12, $13 billion in the bank doesn't mean you can actually just dip into it to make up the difference.
That's coming up later in the show. But first, tonight is the night Ford reveals the electrified F-150 in a live webcast at 9:30 p.m. Eastern. Oh, the buildup. Can America's best-selling vehicle leave its history of fossil fuels in the dust? Could an electric truck ever satisfy those of us for whom the mythos of the truck is the thing? And can we even charge these if everybody buys them? Phoebe Wall Howard covers business, including the auto industry, for the Detroit Free Press, and she joins us now to help answer these questions and more. Phoebe, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I know that you had an eye on Joe Biden's visit yesterday in Dearborn. Did you get a look at his run on the track?
Yes, and it was fast. And I think that's what people are wondering with this new vehicle. They're talking about speed and power.
It's funny. I always had Joe figured as a Corvette guy.
He is a Corvette guy, which makes it very interesting. Bill Ford challenged Biden to see if the F-150 Lightning could compare.
Challenged him to it. Is it true that I thought that maybe Ford didn't know that he was actually going to drive it?
No, they didn't know. And they were warned that, like, you know, just be ready. It's not in the plan, but that Joe Biden can be unpredictable. And in this case, it was unpredictable. You know, you talked about the power and what current owners are thinking. You know, how apprehensive are people about going to all electric for a truck? And what sets the F-150 apart from all other trucks, like the Cybertruck by Tesla, is that this is a daily work truck. That's why it's the best-selling vehicle in America, that this is run by, you know, construction workers and plumbers and electricians and general contractors, and that can't change. What was notable when Joe Biden accelerated aggressively during his visit is the level of pickup and torque, that electric vehicles are known for an immediate response, incredible power. So that is something that current F-150 owners would appreciate.
Sure. So like I said, the big reveal is tonight at 9:30. I know the exact details are not public yet, but has Ford said anything about what to expect other than, yes, it will be a powerful truck?
No, except a little tiny morsel leaked. After Joe Biden took his run, he asked the press corps if anyone had their stopwatch, and he was pretty sure he went 0 to 60 in 4.4 seconds. And that, in fact, when he turned, you know, one of the Ford representatives said, sir, that hasn't been revealed.
It's so hard to hold on to that embargo when the president of the United States is previewing your truck.
Exactly. That's exactly it. So we will find out officially, the public will find out the actual data points. But that, of course, would be faster than the current F-150.
Right. Phoebe, how would you rate the degree of difficulty of what Ford is trying to pack into the Lightning, all the power, all the towing capability at whatever price point they think they can do?
It's a challenge, but they've done two things that make it possible. Number one, they're now doing, they're making the batteries themselves. They're vertically integrating. And that is a huge issue because the single biggest challenge is the weight of the batteries. And Ford has an entire team that works explicitly on that, you know, the engineering team. So in terms of the challenges facing Ford Motor Company, again, we're talking about battery size and battery weight, and that's now what the Van Dyke formerly transmission plant is doing. They've all moved over to the all-electric operation. And secondly, what makes it possible for Ford is they already have a loyal buyer base. It's so enormous. This is a matter of taking that trust and transferring it to electric. Again and again, they say, you know, no shopper will buy this pickup because it's electric. They'll buy it because it can pull more, it has more power, and it's more efficient.
Do we have a ballpark sense of what the Lightning battery might weigh compared with, say, a traditional car battery or even a traditional electric car battery?
We don't have the detail released on that other than it will be enormous.
Is the battery the reason that the electric truck space hasn't opened up faster?
Yeah, think of the battery for vehicles like you would think of the battery for your cell phone. So back in the day, you know, cell phones were like bricks. And now, you know, things get smaller and smaller, you know, with every version of the cell phone. And that's really what it's like for vehicles as well. So it's about space and weight. And again, this is something, because the vehicles Ford and other motor companies have moved into the hybrid space, right? They use both gas and battery, that this is something they've been working on for quite some time. It hasn't just begun for all electric. So this is just doing more with a smaller piece.
Some people buy trucks because they think they look awesome. And some people buy trucks because they know they want to haul stuff around in the truck bed. But like you said, there's a significant portion of the truck market is people who want to haul stuff, be it boats, be it professional equipment. Do you think we know enough about how electric batteries perform at hauling to know exactly how this might pan out for the Lightning?
I think the fact that Ford is considered, I would say widely considered, an expert in truck use, that because Ford has been working on this for 3 years, because they do things like pull trains and double-decker, I mean, they're testing, in fact, all the auto companies, the torture testing on trucks, including batteries, is almost something out of a movie in terms of temperatures and mud and ice and beating on things. You know, it is called torture testing for a reason. So in terms of what the battery can sustain, again, the fact that you've had hybrid batteries, you know, this is an area that the companies are moving into, and it is familiar. So it will come out in 2022, the F-150 Lightning, but the testing will continue, and it's very aggressive.
You know, you mentioned that a significant part of Ford's customer base are people in agriculture, people in the trades, people who need trucks for work and for very, very practical reasons. But I've got to wonder if Ford or Rivian or anyone really knows who the electric truck market is yet. You know, that there might be people who'd be willing to go there if they thought there was a product out there that was really great. Do you get a sense that they have done a lot of research on this?
Yeah, same thing, just like torture testing, these companies, and especially Ford. Because I cover Ford, I'm the most familiar with it as a company. The amount of research where they actually, they live with families. They spend time with businesses. The amount of money they do on customer research, it's not a phrase, it's a reality. And so they study the personal habits and how people talk. They sit in parking lots and watch people load up and unload. And they go to campsites and watch how people use vehicles. Very specifically, Matt Anderson over at the Henry Ford said to me, the reason the F-150 has had the longevity and dominance is because it is both a workhorse and it can be considered a luxury pickup. Exactly your point. So it's both, it's used in the workplace, but you have a lot of families now because they have boats or other recreational activity. They want to use the truck as their family vehicle. Clearly, Tesla is looking at the Cybertruck for to be sexy and to be cool. I mean, that's been a Tesla product point of pride. As far as the F-150 goes, I think they're going for a couple things, just like Ford did for the Mustang Mach-E. They want it to be cool, but they have to build on current loyalty. It's also much more efficient if someone is in love with your product and you switch how it works, as opposed to trying to convince them to buy something completely new. That is one strategy that makes Ford a little bit unique. They're taking products you already know, and they're fully electrifying them. It's totally a different approach. So this will be, yes, people will go into all electric vehicles, as you said, because some folks think trucks inherently are just bad for the planet. And so by moving to all electric, it alleviates a lot of guilt for a number of consumers.
Phoebe, one last thing. I'm assuming the fact that Ford is making this launch is some kind of indicator that they believe that the infrastructure in places where truck buyers live, if it's not there now, at least it can be there very soon. Do you know anything about Ford's research into what will support these trucks?
Yeah, I think Ford Motor Company, along with General Motors and Stellantis, Toyota, absolutely, and others, they are working very aggressively with the White House under Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. And they perceive this infrastructure bill as seriously about not just jobs, but absolutely about charging. When you are in California and you go to the shopping mall, you have countless charging stations. When you go to downtown San Francisco, you can park in slots for charging. There are certain communities, even in Port Huron, Michigan, there's a whole charging slot in banks. So you have different parts of the country that have made these commitments, but really it depends on the White House making this move and this investment. But that goes to your point. It needs to move very quickly for adoption. You cannot have distance anxiety, driving anxiety. Can you fill up? Although people have told me when I interview them, they can go from California to the East Coast, Atlanta, with no stress, that all these electric vehicles actually have maps on where you stop and where you plug in. So the infrastructure is essential, but we are not there yet. We need to get there quickly.
Phoebe Howard covers Ford and other business topics for the Detroit Free Press. You can read her really fun article about Joe Biden's visit online, and you can follow her on Twitter at Phoebe Said. Phoebe, thank you so much.
Thank you.
In a moment, a comprehensive look at the Detroit police and Black citizens who were killed by police at the height of the civil rights movement. That's after a short break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The digital age, in which we can show others real time what's going on in our lives, has been a watershed moment in how America talks about police misconduct. Law enforcement abuses have been documented all across the nation. For some, it raises a new level of awareness. For others, these moments are validations of what's been going on for so very long. A new exhibition suggests a more systemic way of exploring these problems rather than just scrolling through your feeds. Matt Lassiter is a history professor at the University of Michigan. He's the founder and director of the Policing and Social Justice History Lab. He's also the lead author and editor of an online exhibit called Detroit Under Fire that catalogs abuses by Detroit police from 1957 through 1973. Matt, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for inviting me.
So what we're talking about here is a series of online experiences that you and the team have pulled together. And these include some show-stopping photographs, artifacts from newspapers of the period, lots and lots of narratives and information in text form, maps, some data graphics. Can you start out by telling us how you began to think about expressing police violence in this way rather than in some other format, by like maybe just publishing a book?
So this project began after the Michael Brown killing in Ferguson, Missouri. And we were thinking about how to contribute to the Black Lives Matter motivated debate that the country was having, and in particular to provide historical context for the larger patterns and processes. And so we decided to mobilize undergraduate researchers in particular, and to try to figure out the answers to a question that has been deliberately kept silent, which is, how many people did the Detroit Police Department kill during the civil rights era? it's impossible to even know that basic information. Who were they? What happened? What are the larger patterns of police brutality, misconduct, just interactions with the Black community in a northern city during this time period, and what are its legacies?
Can I ask how your conversation with the students and just sort of how the shape of the project, how it was informed by what is or isn't reported in the media?
So we started out heading into the archives, and we did inventory the newspapers to the best that we could, but most of the time, what you can find in the newspapers, if you find anything at all during this period, was a very brief report that was just the police version of what happened. So it would say, Negro, 19 years old, was shot by the Detroit Police Department while running from the scene of a crime. And often there would be almost nothing else. And so we decided that we wanted to, first of all, try to figure out as many of these stories as we could. We headed to the archives at Wayne State University, which has an amazing collection of civil rights and labor history, the Detroit Public Library, which has a lot of the mayor's papers. And we tried to dig up as much information as we could beyond what you can find in the daily newspapers. And what we found is that although the police department records are sealed and very hard to get into, whenever the community would protest, whenever a family would really push a case, or the NAACP or a Black Power group would start a mass movement, then the mayor would tend to get the police department file, the Homicide Bureau report. And we also found a lot of information in the files of the city's civil rights agency, the Detroit Commission on Community Relations, until 1968. And after 1968, the police department stonewalled the Detroit Commission on Community Relations completely, refused to share any information with them. And so that really ran cold right at the moment when the police department in Detroit really escalated its use of fatal force. But we just tried to gather as much as we could. I want to make one thing really clear. Almost everything that we've documented on our exhibit was documented during the 1960s and 1970s. By civil rights and Black power organizations, and by the people in the communities who were most impacted by this. And what we did was just go try to find the work that they had already done and bring it back to the public and make it available to those communities as well.
You turned up a lot. And some of these incidents are stories that people might remember or know something about. And some of it feels like very fresh data. There's one statistic that you compiled that during a 7-year period from 1967 to 1973, more than 100 unarmed Black people were killed by the Detroit police. And even if people knew the scope of the problem, that fact is just, it's so stark and it's so awful to see. Was it hard to put together a number like that? Could you maybe take us through, you know, what it took to even get to that sentence?
So I think this is a conservative estimate because much of the information we have is still just the newspaper report. But as a broader goal of this project, we would like to see the Wayne County prosecutor and the Michigan state government make all of these records available, that when the state kills somebody and there's an investigation, that should be public. Communities demanded it at the time, and they often didn't get it. But here's how we went at this. First of all, we did a pattern analysis assessment as best we could, getting as much information as we could from the archives and from media reports. I think what we found is just the tip of the iceberg. The 100 unarmed people shot in the 7-year period is an estimate, and there are about 15 cases where the official police version is that those unarmed people had knives, but we are classifying them as unarmed because there is a huge amount of evidence that police officers carried knives. They were called drop knives so that they could use them to frame somebody in the event of a questionable or wrongful shooting. And the police officer who participated in the killing of 8 to 10 people during the early 1970s was proved to have framed his final victim by planting a knife on him after shooting him down. And there's a lot of evidence that people were framed. They were said to be armed when they weren't. But even putting that aside, the police department, as official policy, encouraged officers to shoot unarmed and fleeing, quote unquote, suspects. And the department allowed this before 1967, but did not actively encourage it. And during the 1967 uprising, often called the Detroit Riot, the police department and the National Guard shot and killed more than 30 Black people, mostly young males, for allegedly looting, often shooting into a group of people unarmed. And the policy said that you couldn't shoot and kill somebody unless there was no other way to apprehend the fleeing fugitive. And after 1967, the police department changed that policy and said that the decision of whether the shooting was justified would rest in this quote unquote sound discretion of the police officer. And this was part of a larger surge throughout the country in the late 60s and beyond to put authority to use fatal force in the discretionary split second judgment of a police officer. And so in the next 5 to 6 years, the Detroit Police Department then encouraged fatal force against unarmed, fleeing, alleged robbers and burglars.
In what way?
The clearest evidence that the department encouraged this was the formation of the stress unit, Stop the Robberies, Enjoy Safe Streets, in the early 1970s. And the stress unit, its official justification was that it was going to protect Black citizens from street crime because they suffered the most. And statistically, that's true. Black citizens did suffer the most from street crime. But stress was an undercover decoy unit. Almost all of the undercover officers were white. And it's really preposterous to protect Black citizens with an undercover decoy unit of white officers. And they also deployed mainly in the parts of the city that were gentrifying, the Cass Corridor, which now is called Midtown Detroit. It's where the museums and Wayne State University, and it's where white, you know, suburbanites go into the city now to go to breweries. And this was about really policing the color line. Many of the people shot and killed by stress, civil rights and Black power groups proved, were not even involved in a crime. And this was an active policy. The commander of stress said that what is at stake here is whether we can, quote unquote, police the Black community. And it was really a response to the very clear sign that the demographics were changing and that soon African Americans would be a majority in Detroit, would elect a mayor, would be able to have control to some extent over the police department. And white neighborhoods were demanding that the line be held, the segregation line. And the police department was an instrument in this effort to maintain white control of a segregated city. And what we found in our mapping is that a huge percentage of the fatal force incidents, as many other kinds of police brutality and misconduct, including racial profiling and stop and frisk, happen along the color line. They happen in white neighborhoods, bordering Black neighborhoods. They happened in commercial districts. The police were not going into the poorest Black communities that were called the highest crime areas very much during this period. They weren't really protecting those communities from crime at all. They were defending the color line with fatal force and other types of police violence.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking today with University of Michigan professor Matt Lassiter. He's founder and director of the Policing and Social Justice History Lab, and also is the lead author and editor of an online exhibit called Detroit Under Fire. It catalogs Detroit police abuses from 1957 through 1973. Can I ask, how did you talk to the students about officer narratives and departmental narratives of this time? Because, I mean, on the one hand, I could see taking on this project with the understanding that there needs to be a wider lens on this than what the official record has to tell us. But on the other hand, were there some details that you wouldn't have gotten any other way? Or did you see some value in explaining things the way that officers explain them.
So it's a complicated project to take undergraduate students into the archives like this. And we try to do a few things. We interviewed a former Black police officer in Detroit, Ike McKinnon, who actually went on to become the chief of police. And he told us his perspective as both an officer and as a Black kid growing up in Detroit who was brutalized by the police. And he has talked about this incident a lot, who remembered the crash crackdown of 1959, 1960, when the police department illegally arrested 1,500 African-American males as murder suspects, and they all had murder suspect on their permanent record. And he told us these stories, and he also told us what it was like to be a police officer when you witness brutality. He told us a story about witnessing brutality by white officers and reporting it and having the hierarchy say, don't tell us about this. Do you want your career to be over? And so we try to get that perspective. We didn't have time in the initial phase of the project to do a lot of interviews, but this project is continuing. And one of the things that we want to do is interview more people, interview the family members of people who are impacted and the rest. But when you're leading students in a history project, you know, the best history is a history that gets as many perspectives as you can. And I want to emphasize that our website has about 1,500 archival documents on it. And we would put the newspaper reports on it too, but that's a copyright problem. And we want to allow viewers of the website to read through the documents and make their own determinations. Every Freedom of Information Act file that we get, we're putting the whole thing on the website and breaking it down into all of its different parts. And so we offer our interpretations, but we're also designing a curriculum. And this is available for the public, for impacted families and communities to go through, for police officers too, to go through and really look at the documents that we found, make their own determinations. People are welcome to send us more documents and accounts, and we'll put those on the website as well.
Mm-hmm. There's so much here, but there was something that jumped out at me that I wanted to ask you about, and that's research the team did about violence against women. Can you tell us a little bit about what you found?
We found an enormous amount of violence against women, and I think scholars and activists have increasingly been arguing that violence against Black women in particular has been undercounted in this country because, you know, 90% or more of the people incarcerated are males. The mass incarceration debate has centered largely around Black males, Latinx males. And what we found going back into Detroit is that the police department was particularly brutal against Black women in the following ways. First of all, against sex workers, so-called prostitutes. There was massive police corruption around the sex trade and around the drug trade during this period. And one of the most important incidents in Detroit's history was the killing of Cynthia Scott, a young Black female sex worker who was shot in the back by a white officer when she refused to submit to an illegal arrest, and then he planted a knife on her and he was exonerated. There were massive protests. And what makes this so important is that it was the first time in the 1960s when the majority of the protesters in the streets were poor and working class people, because this hit home. This was in a so-called vice district. This affected people who were working in the underground economy. And it was a real turning point in Detroit's history because it helped bring radical activists and organizations to the forefront of the police brutality movement. The other major patterns of violence against women that we documented were the police department pulled hundreds of thousands of motorists over every year in racial profiling incidents, often when they were in white neighborhoods or just downtown. And if Black people complained about that and asserted their constitutional rights, they would often get brutalized in response. And so we have a lot of incidents of Black women who are in cars and they protest the deprivation of their constitutional rights, and the reaction is violence. And the other major category that we found, well, two really, Black mothers who complained about brutality against their sons and filed formal complaints were often targeted for abuse, wrongful arrest, retaliatory violence. And we've documented this based on their own protest accounts in a number of cases. And then Black female political activists, especially young Black women who are involved in Black power movements in high schools and colleges, were also targeted for police violence.
We're going to take a quick break. In a moment, we continue our conversation with Matt Lassiter about Detroit Police Department's abuse and violence that occurred between 1957 and 1973. We'll find out if charges were brought against officers and get into the cultural and political motivations of the times.
Police violence was systemic. By mapping, we've shown that it was along the color line. It was not about crime control. It was about racial control. It was about infiltration, surveillance, and crackdowns on political activists. It was political police violence.
Stay with us. You're with Stateside. I'm April Baer. Let's continue my conversation now with University of Michigan Professor Matt Lassiter. He's lead author and editor of the online exhibition Detroit Under Fire. It catalogs extensive Detroit police abuses from 1957 through 1973.
What did you find out about whether officers involved in these cases ever faced criminal charges?
Oh, it almost never happened. The thing about the discretionary use of force standard that you could shoot somebody when they're fleeing is a lot of the incidents were technically justifiable under that standard. But if you did a wrongful shooting or just killed somebody, murdered somebody, it was a self-exoneration script. You just said that they were fleeing and you suspected them of being a burglar. And the police department set up an internal investigative process in the 60s in response to civil rights protests. The civil rights groups wanted an civilian review board that would be elected and independent. And they didn't get that. They never got that. But the police department set up an internal investigative process and they just whitewashed investigations systematically. We documented that no police officer was fired during the 1960s for any incident. And, you know, we're talking about felony level assault and worse, so many incidents. Mass brutality against nonviolent civil rights activists, the kind of story that we think is a Southern story, but it happened in Detroit over and over again. And the police department, the Homicide Bureau, the Internal Investigative Agency, and the Wayne County prosecutor almost never did anything. And here's the most striking finding. If they never took the word of a Black person or even 10 Black people over the word of a white officer. If 8 Black witnesses said this person was unarmed and that officer just shot them dead for no reason, and one officer and his partner said, we were attacked with a knife, I was defending myself. They always took the word of white officers. They almost never took the word of white citizens over white officers, but there just weren't as many incidents. They just didn't. In the early to mid 60s, the investigations would call Black witnesses biased. And what they mean in the Cynthia Scott investigation, for example, when 6 African-American witnesses said she was shot and framed, the investigation said they were biased, but they were biased because they were Black. The idea was that they couldn't be expected to give truthful testimony because they were also Black people, and therefore they were disqualified from being legal witnesses. I mean, it's really quite extraordinary. And the prosecutor deserves an enormous amount of responsibility for the violence in Detroit during this time. But so does the mayor, and so do the white neighborhoods, which openly called for these kind of crackdowns. Thousands of letters to the mayor that we discovered demanding tough policing, demanding a stop and frisk law, which Detroit passed in 1968, opposing a civilian review board and saying, if we put handcuffs on the police, then Black criminals will run rampant throughout our city. But mostly what the police were doing was harassing regular people as they went about their daily business and illegally cracking down on political activists. That's what they spent a huge amount of their time doing during the 1960s.
Matt, what do you feel like we gain when we look at these interactions in through such a macro lens? I think some people might take all this in and say, I wish I knew more about the individual interactions, which in many cases, I guess we'll just never know. But what do you think is gained by looking at the big picture in this way?
What we've documented is only the tip of the iceberg. And the vast majority of encounters never made it into the archive. You know, the extent of this is unknowable. What we gain, first of all, I think, is an appreciation that the urban North was not the opposite of the Jim Crow South during this period. It was the Jim Crow North. And scholars and activists have been arguing this for a long time, but it is difficult for our country, for white Americans, that it's comforting to think that the worst racism was in Mississippi and Alabama. But the level of police violence in Detroit, I doubt any Southern city police department killed nearly as many Black people as the Detroit Police Department, the Chicago Police Department, the Los Angeles Police Department did during the civil rights era. So police violence was systemic. By mapping, we've shown that it was along the color line. It was not about crime control. It was about racial control. It was about infiltration, surveillance, and crackdowns on political activists. It was political police violence. And the second thing that I think we gain is an appreciation for how vibrant and longstanding the resistance movement against this racialized police violence has been. The George Floyd protests or the Michael Brown Black Lives Matter surge brought new attention to this, as if this was a new thing, a kind of next stage of the civil rights movement, to have police be the target. But during the 1960s and 1970s, police brutality was in some ways the most important campaign for civil rights and Black power activists at particular moments. They saw the police, along with housing segregation, employment discrimination, school segregation, as part of an apparatus of racial control. And we went into this project to document police violence. But what we also ended up documenting, and many other scholars have done this as well, is an incredible outpouring of activism, because most of the evidence we could find was created by these activists at the time. And then the third important point for what this project shows is that the discretionary procedures and cover-up processes that are allowing police violence to flourish today and that are under attack by activists were largely put in place during the 1960s and 1970s in response to that activist challenge to unchecked police violence. The removal of legal responsibility from individual officers, the qualified immunity, the investigative processes that were opaque and invisible to the public, the use of force guidelines that put total discretion in the officer. Those were created for political and racial control reasons in response to demands during the 1960s and 1970s for community control and civilian oversight over the police.
Matt Lassiter, professor of history at U of M and the founder and director of the Policing and Social Justice History Lab. Detroit Under Fire is online right now, and you can look through all of its offerings. Matt, how long do you expect the online exhibition will be? Is this something that'll be up in perpetuity?
Oh, this is permanent. This is the equivalent of a book. So it'll be up for, you know, until the web platforms go away and we have to redesign it.
Well, thank you very much for talking to us about this.
Thanks so much for letting us share these resources with you and your listeners.
Amid the other news of the week, a conversation's underway in Lansing about Michigan's investments in higher education. Republican leaders controlling Michigan's House and Senate are proposing substantial changes in where the funding goes. This amid the backdrop of a terrifying academic year for higher education, in which an already stressed-out business model got turned upside down for distance learning and shifts in who's going to college and where they do so. Chad Livengood is a senior editor for Crain's Detroit Business who wrote about this recently. Hey, Chad, welcome back to Stateside.
Hey, thanks for having me, April.
So what is in the House Republicans' higher ed plan? Can you lay it out for us?
So they've got a plan that is trying to attempt to have state funding follow state students, as in residents of Michigan. By doing that, they are greatly reducing state funding for a couple of the state's flagship universities, the University of Michigan and Wayne State University, which have high proportions of out-of-state students. University of Michigan, 47% of the kids come from out-of-state. They also pay three times as much for the right to get an education at U of M. And so the cuts that happen in this budget amount to, for the first year, 12% for U of M Ann Arbor and 4% for Wayne State. And then the money is being used to essentially redistribute the wealth. It's not really an actual meaningful increase in funding for higher ed, but what it does is it then spreads that money out into almost 10% increases in funding for Oakland University, Central Michigan, Eastern Michigan, Ferris State, Saginaw Valley, universities that traditionally have a much higher proportion of students who are Michigan residents. What they also did was when they built this formula, they realized they were going to give big 7-8% cuts to the universities in the Upper Peninsula, Northern Michigan, Michigan Tech, and Lake Superior State. So what the lawmakers did was they just exempted the UP schools from their formula because those schools also have high proportions of out-of-state students. And they kind of went after the big boys, so to speak, U of M, Ann Arbor, and Wayne State, under the guise that these universities have big endowments and could have quote-unquote afford to take a cut. But the universities, you talk to them, you know, and anybody knows anything about endowments, just because you have $12, $13 billion in the bank doesn't mean you can actually just dip into it to make up the difference.
Yeah, it's considered generally pretty bad practice in nonprofit management. Do you see this necessarily as a poke at schools in more urban or more affluent communities like Detroit and Ann Arbor, places that traditionally vote blue? Or is there something deeper here about who our higher ed system is really built for?
Yeah, it's definitely got the undertones of sort of a partisan attack. I should also mention this is actually a three-year plan they've put together that at the end of the third year, U of M would have a 38% reduction in state funding, $122 million fewer tax dollars flowing from Lansing to Ann Arbor by 2024. Wayne State wouldn't have as much of a bloodbath, but it would be $28 million or 14% less state funding. What also happens is because some other universities have a high proportion of out-of-state students, but not nearly as much as U of M and Wayne State, such as Michigan State University and Western, they would get about a 1% or 2% increase over 3 years, which effectively, with the rate of inflation, that's effectively still a cut.
It feels like, Chad, at places like U of M, it's sort of an unspoken truth that the tuition of out-of-state students makes a lot of other things possible at the university. Is there any concern among the makers of this bill, so to speak, that they might be doing some damage to the state's higher education system by undermining what is basically a source of revenue?
You don't get a sense of that from talking to the lawmakers who are behind this, one of which is Representative Thomas Albert, the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee, who is actually, in fact, a U of M Ann Arbor graduate and has an MBA from Michigan State. He doesn't seem to be fazed by this idea. They're really kind of honed in on the idea that U of M has this massive multi-billion dollar endowment and can't afford to take the haircut. And I've covered higher ed funding since I was in college at Central myself, like for now off and on for the past 17, 18 years in Michigan. This issue of higher education funding really is really much a symptom of term limits. There is constant turnover in Lansing, and nobody has really been around long enough to know the history of it. We are still almost $500 million less per year in funding for universities that we were at the beginning of this century. There has been a systematic disinvestment that dates back to Michigan's decade-long single-state recession before the Great Recession, and we never really recovered from that. And now you see the effects of COVID. And suddenly, even the stranger part of all this is the state is flush with cash this year, because the economy is coming back quite nicely, and because they got multiple billions of dollars of stimulus money, and yet the lawmakers are not really proposing to use any of that to help these universities or invest it all, make one-time investments in universities. They're proposing this new, completely different and quite radical way of funding higher education on a per pupil basis that would really change things dramatically. I should also mention Grand Valley State, Oakland University, and Central Michigan, others, they would see at the end of 3 years, 33 to 35% increase in funding. So it is really a dramatic change in the way we would approach higher education funding in Michigan.
Chad, I wanted to ask you about another issue that I know you've got an eye on, and that's unemployment benefits. The state has recently restored the rule that says that if you're receiving unemployment benefits, which a lot of people are right now, you need to actively be searching for work. What's the political tension going on behind this in Lansing?
Yeah, I mean, the tension is there's 800,000 people collecting unemployment every week. There is this new benefit in the American Rescue Plan that extended a $300 a week additional benefit on top of the maximum $362 a week benefit through Labor Day. And there are businesses, mostly in the hospitality industry, that are just desperate for workers. They cannot get applicants. A couple of weeks ago, the Macomb and St. Clair County Michigan Works Office held a virtual job fair. They advertised that they had 500 jobs in hotels and restaurants. They had about 4 applicants actually show up for this virtual job fair. And so there's a lot of pressure to get at least restore the requirement that if you're on unemployment, you have to apply for at least one job a week and show some documentation of that. And then there's all this, and this is mostly led by the Chamber of Commerce and various business groups. They want to see Michigan follow the lead of a lot of Republican-run states that are simply waiving this $300 a week and getting rid of it because they think it's a benefit that's preventing people from going back to work because they can make $662 a week on unemployment, and you'd have to be working at least a $16 an hour job to match that.
I think there's plenty to say about how workers feel about the safety of returning to the workforce right now, but I got to say, I am seeing these help wanted signs up all over in my neighborhood. What's the craziest thing you've seen employers doing to try to get people to apply?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen if you go on Craigslist, you can just find like restaurant worker jobs, and there are restaurants, small and big, offering $200, $300, $400, $500 for signing bonuses. A source of mine in Petoskey sent me a picture a couple weeks ago of a Subway offering $18 an hour to be a sandwich artist at a Subway. In Petoskey. Yeah. But you know what? Here's the problem about Petoskey is even if you got that job, good luck finding a place to live in Petoskey or within 20 minutes of Petoskey. That's one of the biggest challenges, particularly in Traverse City and Petoskey and some of these Lake Michigan towns, is they know that the tourists are coming back and they're going to come back hard this summer. And there just may not be enough workers, enough labor supply within those areas to support that. And that's partly a reflection of the cost of housing in some of these areas.
Chad Livengood, senior editor at Crain's Detroit Business. You can find his writing online. Chad, thanks so much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Tomorrow on the show, we're going to hear from the owner of one bar in Ypsilanti that's among the many Michigan businesses trying to find workers. and continue to navigate the pandemic. And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thank you so much for listening. See you tomorrow.